This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. By the way, Josh, where's Harvey?
Don't you know?
Oh, well, the last time I saw him, he was with you. Oh, but he's probably waiting for me down at Charlie's.
Yes, that's it. He's down at Charlie's.
Well, in that case, I think I'll go down and join him for a nightcap. Fortunately, Charlie's stays open rather late.
If only Adam's imaginary friend were a six-foot bunny like Elwood P. Dowd's Harvey. Instead, I have to pretend that Michael Fassbender's in the studio with us.
He actually prefers Mike.
I'm sure he does. Well, in honor of Mike, this week's Film Spotting Top 5 is Unseen Characters. Plus, the great Iranian director Abbas Kiarostami takes his talents to Tokyo for his latest, Like Someone in Love. Our review and more.
You going to stick around for Massacre Theater this week, Mike?
It's all ahead on Film Spotting.
Film Spotting is presented by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create a professional website, blog, portfolio, and now an online store. Check out their new commerce solution so you can start selling stuff immediately. For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase on new accounts, go to squarespace.com/film and use offer code FILM3.
We're also sponsored by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/film. Later in the show, we'll offer up a few download recommendations.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Josh, and due to the inclement weather, the heavy snowfall here in Chicago, we're actually doing something that we haven't done in over 250 shows here on Film Spotting. You've never had this experience, Josh.
No.
We're taping this, not at WBEZ, but in old school podcast fashion, in an office with
yes.
fairly cheap microphones.
It's a secret bunker, really. We found a Film Spotting secret bunker to do this.
Should be a fun show. Just as our secret bunker is unseen, we're going to share our top five unseen characters later in the show. So think about, for example, Rebecca from the Hitchcock film Rebecca. Title character, plays a pivotal role, and yet you never actually see her throughout the course of the film. That's where we're going with this week's top five.
But first, Iranian master Abbas Kiarostami goes to Japan to make his latest movie, which he names after an American jazz standard. The result of all this multiculturalism? Like Someone in Love.
Veteran Japanese TV and film actor Denden cajoling one of his college-age prostitutes, Aikiko, played by Rin Takanashi, to take an important but mysterious late-night job in an early scene from Like Someone in Love, available via cable on demand and also in theaters in Chicago and select cities this weekend. Reluctantly, Aikiko goes, and after a long taxi ride, encounters a professor and widower named Takashi, whom she develops a curious relationship with over the course of a couple days. Fans of Kiarostami's last film, one of our favorites of 2011, Certified Copy, will certainly see similarities in the two works beyond the fact that they're both set outside the director's native country. Extended scenes consisting of intimate conversations, confused identities, subtle, often sublime cinematography, and puzzling plots that one can summarize with a few sentences, as I just did, without at all describing what the films are really about. There's another recent art house film, though, that's been on my mind since seeing Like Someone in Love. One of our favorites from last year, Josh, the Turkish movie Once Upon a Time in Anatolia. At first, it was nothing more than their comparably deliberate hypnotic tempos. And something our friend Michael Phillips said recently on the show when discussing Anatolia and director Nuri Bilge Ceylan. If the film is effective, it changes your temperament. It brings you into its own rhythm. And even if it's a struggle at first and you find yourself a little itchy, give it 10 to 15 minutes. If you're in the hands of a really strong filmmaker, you can get there. But it later occurred to me that there's another, deeper connection. Both movies are primarily concerned with the ambiguities and mysteries of human interaction. And not for nothing, both devote a good deal of their running times to people confined in and talking in cars, a recurring Kiarostami conceit. Josh, to really connect with challenging, non-traditional narratives like the ones I've mentioned, I think it's crucial for the viewer to find their personal in. It might be something particular about the style, a performance, a provocative theme, something that grabs you and compels you, to borrow Michael's phrase, to change your temperament. You found an in with Anatolia and Certified Copy. Did you find one with Like Someone in Love?
That is a great question, because you're so right with this film, and it's the same conversation I had with people about Anatolia, telling them, hang in there for those first few minutes, more than a few minutes, actually. And Like Someone in Love begins quite similarly with this static shot of a restaurant and the busyness going on. We hear someone talking. We're not quite sure who. You spend a lot of time trying to figure out, is it someone I'm looking at? Is it someone behind the camera? And that early scene is going to be the moment where you're in or you're out. I think you're right. And you have to decide at that point, am I going to go with this and see where it takes me? Or am I just, do I want some action right now? Will I lose intellectual credibility if I say my in with Like Someone in Love was just the gorgeous visuals at the beginning? I mean, from that opening shot, which didn't give you a lot of plot information, if anything, mystified you more as it went on, it didn't matter, because the composition of it, the movement of the people, which is natural, yet you know so intricately choreographed, the light and color at play. There's a moment where Akiko is sitting in the restaurant and she's trying to decide if she's going to take this assignment or visit her grandmother, who is the unseen character in this film. And we see that her manager, who's really her pimp, is outside the restaurant in front of the window. And the reflection of his white shirt, his business shirt that he's wearing, kind of hovers over her through the window so that he's haunting her. And Like Someone in Love has so many moments like that where you can just get lost in the composition and realize what's being communicated through that, that all of the other intricate levels that are going on almost don't matter. Now, they do in the end. When you're done with a film, that's when you can start putting those together. And I really did spend a lot of time afterwards trying to do that. But I had no problem going with this all along just because of how it looked.
Yeah, I think that is a huge part of why this film is so effective. We're going to really get into that, I think, especially get into that opening scene a little bit later. And you're right, I didn't need either much of a hook to get me into this film after that amazing opening scene. But there were really two ins for me with this film. One was purely visual. The other was a line of dialogue. And the dialogue comes after the visual in for me, but I want to start with it because it was the line that was my cipher. It was my key to breaking the code of this film, if you will. It was like a puzzle piece that you finally put in place and it reveals the true picture. And it's during that first meeting with Akiko and Takashi, the older man, the widower who has hired her for the evening. They get into a conversation about a famous painting that he has on his wall. It features a young woman that looks very similar to her, and she jokes about how her uncle had told her that it was a portrait of her and that he had painted it for her. So right away, of course, Certified Copy is running through my head. I'm flashing back to that great film. But he remarks that the woman in the kimono in the painting is teaching the parrot in the painting to speak. And Akiko says something really fascinating. She says she always thought it was the other way around. It was the parrot teaching the woman to speak. And that ambiguity, that difference in perception, sums up the entire film for me, especially, as you touched on some of them, all of the film's reflective imagery. You've got the same painting, two people in the same room looking at it from basically the same vantage point, but they see a completely different reality in the painting. It's a subtle difference that's nevertheless a huge difference, and I think it reflects potentially drastically different worldviews, which is the essence of art. And I don't know that any filmmaker understands that essence and that ambiguity better than Kiarostami.
Yeah, that's the definite certified copy moment for me as well, as when they do discuss that painting. Yet further on, as the movie proceeds, we get another parallel in which role-playing is a factor. Takashi comes upon Akiko's abusive boyfriend at one point, and the boyfriend isn't quite sure what the relationship is, so he assumes that Takashi is her grandfather. And Takashi does nothing to dissuade him from that. He doesn't really encourage it, but he lets it go along. And then later, Takashi has this nosy neighbor, and Akiko is sitting outside Takashi's stoop, and the neighbor assumes she's his granddaughter. Mm-hmm. And again, she doesn't really encourage it, but she plays along.
It's easier to play along.
It's easier to play along. And of course, that mirrors certified copy, where roles are assumed. It's much more vague in certified copy whether or not the central couple are playing at the beginning when they're acquaintances, or whether they're playing at the end when they begin speaking to each other as if they're married.
The key difference is, in certified copy, the audience doesn't know the truth. We're not in on the riddle, whereas in this case, we are in on
So I think Like Someone in Love is a little more straightforward in that sense. But what it did reveal to me is the nature of this relationship between this younger woman and this older man, how it's more about what they're yearning for on a deeper level than what they contracted at the beginning. That transition was quite touching to follow, and also to see how that in itself is sort of a fantasy. While they're playing grandfather and granddaughter, in some ways, it may speak to the sort of relationships they really are seeking beyond the client relationship that it begins. But at the same time, that still is a fantasy. And can that sustain itself in this world either, is what the movie is about.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're discussing the new film from the revered Iranian filmmaker Abbas Kiarostami. It's Like Someone in Love, set in Tokyo. I talked about that painting and that conversation that really helped me get into this film. I want to go back to that just for a second, because that notion of what we perceive as reality versus what the world perceives as reality, and this fits along with what you were saying about the misdirection and how they go along with the role playing versus what truly is reality, those can be and often are vastly different things. And you see throughout this film, Kiarostami play with that in a variety of ways. And I mentioned the reflective imagery, but I think you see it as well, specifically in the conflict in some of these characters and how it manifests itself. Aikiko's struggle with what she is, a call girl, and where she came from, what we can gather from some of the conversations and the voicemail messages from her grandmother, that she probably comes from a fairly small town, kind of an innocent girl. She comes to the big city. She gets caught up in something that her family clearly wouldn't approve of. And her grandmother, based on those calls, what we hear, simply can't believe maybe some of the stories she's been hearing about her daughter and her friend. She can't believe that the girl on the flyer soliciting a good time at the train station, who looks just like her granddaughter, could possibly be her granddaughter. She's not willing to accept that truth because of what she thinks she knows. She'd never be a part of that kind of life. You see it as well, though, I think, in Takashi. He's a professor. We're told that Aikiko's boss respects him greatly. He seems learned and respectable. But we actually meet him in a way that mirrors the way we meet Aikiko. He's on the phone, and he's under attack. He's getting badgered by someone who wants him to translate something and wants him to translate it right now. He's just relentless about it and really shows him no respect at all. And I think that's really fascinating, because what you see in these two characters, for me, and what I think maybe Kiarostami is getting at here, is you've got these characters in this world where they're really locked in to tradition. And fair to say, if you look at Certified Copy, and you look at his previous film set in Iran, these are all places, Italy for Certified Copy, that you could argue are predominantly patriarchal. And we certainly see that here. It comes out especially in the form of the boyfriend
right,
and some of his traditional beliefs. But the imagery, the characters, I think this film all culminates to force us to confront the rigidity and the danger in society's perception sometimes of the individual. Like I said, it really comes through with the boyfriend. It hits us almost literally at the film's climax as well. But what they get from each other, you mentioned that relationship and how it starts to play out, and then maybe what we really see they need from each other. They don't get it from anyone else, Josh. I think it's non-judgment. You've got a grandfather figure who, unlike her real grandmother, accepts her for what she is. A call girl, maybe a confused one, but a call girl nevertheless. And on his side, you've got a young woman who doesn't mistreat him because of his age, and who actually does seem to genuinely respect him.
As you're talking about the different aspects of each of these two main figures, it strikes me that the term character development is just so wanting for what Kiarostami is able to do in his films, in the way that we see all the different aspects of their lives, the different personas that they take on. It's just not fitting for the richness he has. He really makes room in his movies for the multiple personalities that we are. And we demand character development. It's one of those requirements of a good film, we say, but so many fall short of the sort of thing we do get in a film like this. I want to go back to that scene you mentioned with the grandmother's phone calls, because we hear a number of them in a row when Akiko listens to her voicemails that she's been ignoring all day. The grandmother's in town to visit and has been leaving these voicemails saying, how can we get together? When are we going to get together? And each one is increasingly sad as it speaks to that realization you're talking about of what has happened to her granddaughter in the big city. And it's a remarkable sequence for the actress playing Akiko, Rin Takanashi, because it's wordless. She's in the back of a taxi at this point. So it's wordless. There's no one else there for her to play off of. And we're listening. We hear the voicemail messages and we just see on her face somehow, because it's mostly impassive until the very end when the messages have piled up and they're really taking their toll on her. But for the majority of that scene, it's impassive. Yet somehow the dialogue has a lot to do with this. The voicemails, you feel the weight of who she was and where she is now, where she's going at that moment in the cab. What a wonderful scene. And there are, of course, adding on to it, you mentioned reflections. So many reflections going on because it is in a vehicle again, which Kiarostami loves. We get through the windshield shot. We get the side shot of Akiko. And not only do we see her face, but the neon lights of Tokyo are reflecting back and forth. It's just a beautifully rich 5-6 minutes of this movie.
I'm glad that you love that sequence so much. I'm disappointed that you just stole all my thunder, though, because I mentioned the other in for me with this film.
It was that scene.
Visual one. It's that sequence where Rin Takanashi is in the back of that cab driving around Tokyo, first listening to her messages, but then she makes a decision, since they're near the train station where her grandmother is.
Yes.
She's not going to go in and actually face her grandmother, but she wants to at least drive by and maybe see her. And maybe she does see her, maybe she doesn't. That's something that isn't completely clear in the film, at least I don't think it is. But if there's a better cinematic sequence than that all year, I'll be surprised. Where without any dialogue and just the combination of the actress's face, the little bit of sadness that starts to show in her eyes, maybe a little bit of tears you can see there through the window and the reflections, the lights reflecting on her, as you said, the neon lights from the city, that moment of despair where you've got a character who's part of this bustling, vibrant metropolis and yet feeling, or at least conveying to me in that moment, the utter loneliness of it all. That's heartbreaking. That was a truly heartbreaking sequence for me.
I think there's an in moment there where you'll know, because it does come fairly early on, maybe the first 20 minutes of the film, where you know you're going to go with this movie or not, and it's how hard you strain to see if one of the figures outside the bus station is the grandmother.
That's right. If she's seeing her.
If she's seeing her. If you're not leaning forward and looking very hard to try to figure out, is that the grandmother or is that the grandmother, then the movie probably isn't going to work for you. So we're praising this as we should, but I do want to talk about the ending.
Okay.
Because it is very distinct from the sort of ambiguity that we're left with in Certified Copy, even though it's also a non-ending. I would say both films have a non-ending ending. Certified Copy, I found the vagueness to be freeing in a way. It now set me loose to start mulling over this. I found the ending here to be jarring in almost an opposite way.
In a way, actually,
it could be.
It could be.
But and I know what you're getting at there. But even I watched the final few seconds again to see, is it supposed to be that definitive? And it wasn't to me. And what it did is it just stopped short in a way that was almost arbitrary, even though I know Kiarostami would not make a film like that. And I've been wrestling with trying to make that piece of the puzzle fit.
Mm-hmm.
That you're exactly right when you describe the film that way. And do you have the key for that for me?
I may have a little bit, because it gets back for me. What is the larger theme of the film in terms of that notion of judgment and non-judgment? And society with their more traditional values accepting or not accepting certain decisions that characters make. And I think the key to that scene, for me anyway, and I watched it again as well, and on the second time, what you notice is, and obviously I don't want to get into spoiler territory here, so I'm going to be, unfortunately, fairly vague here, but you think it's one character in particular who is driving all the action, and it is. He is driving it forward, but that second time, you recognize that there are other voices at play, too. And I think that maybe Kiarostami's saying something about the fact that what's going on, I think we can say, outside this window at the end of the film, it becomes something much larger about society and not just about this one character who's really angry. And it fits in anyway with that theme of judgment. Now, I'm not saying it necessarily culminates in a way that's completely satisfying. It's going to leave you feeling like, what's going on? What did I miss?
But you know what I mean? Sometimes that feels okay, even though you're not given an answer. Not having that is okay. And here it left me wanting.
Yeah, I can see that. For me, it left me wanting in a good way, though. And maybe it was just because the film up to that point had instilled so much goodwill that I was willing to go with whatever Kiarostami was doing. I do want to jump back now and go all the way to the beginning, because even though we touched on it a little bit, I think if we're going to talk about perception in this film and misdirection, we have to talk about that opening scene and what's so great about it, because you have a girl on the phone. It's our main character. We don't know that at this point. You only hear her side of the call. It's a static shot of a restaurant / bar.
And I almost feel like we shouldn't give this away,
maybe so,
because it's not a plot spoiler.
No, it's not at all.
But the discovery of it is such a pleasure.
Yeah, it really is, but I'm going to do it anyway. I can't help it, because I just love it so much, and I want to try to get into what I really love about it, what I think Kiarostami is trying to do there. It immediately challenges your senses, and this movie does that throughout in terms of using sound, in terms of some of the visuals, the way things creep into a frame without the director calling any attention to it. Whether it's a character, sometimes an object, you just have to be paying attention and see that object come in and be ready for what's going to happen with that object or that person. And as we watch this opening scene and we hear this conversation, we see this bar, we see three different conversations, three different tables. And at first you think, is it coming from one of those tables? Are we hearing part of that? And it's only later that we realize that actually where the camera is positioned is essentially like we're observers. We're at the table sitting next to Aikiko as she's on this phone call with her boyfriend. And then what follows that is this brilliant sort of riff on the classic shot reverse shot in cinema, where Kiarostami cuts between what are basically medium close-ups of Aikiko and the room and these people who just rotate in and take the seat in front of her. I love how it keeps us on our toes and sets the table for the entire rest of the film. So that's Abbas Kiarostami's Like Someone in Love. Again, it is out now in select cities, including here in Chicago. This weekend, it's also available via cable on demand.
Yeah, is this one you would almost encourage people to see on demand? Because we both rewound the final minute or so.
And I went
you
back
were describing
and watched other
the,
sequences.
The
yeah.
beginning, I rewound the beginning as well to make sure I was catching everything. So there's that added value you have. Obviously, you're missing the big screen and it's visually gorgeous, so you don't want to give that up. But
no.
It might be nice to watch this.
I think you're onto something, because I did find it very rewarding to go back and watch not only the ending, but the beginning as you did, and that sequence I love so much. I fast-forwarded through a lot of the film and just tried to pick up other little dialogue moments that I appreciated. So there is an advantage in this case, but yeah, I wish I could see it on the big screen as well. If you get a chance to see Like Someone in Love and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us, feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463, or find us on Twitter @filmspotting and facebook.com/filmspotting.
Before we get to our lists of the best unseen characters, Adam and I will play unnamed characters next in Massacre Theater, plus the debut of Ask Film Spotting, post-Oscars edition.
Keeping with the unseen theme here on the show, we're featuring music from Rodriguez this week. He's the subject of the Oscar-winning documentary Searching for Sugar Man, which is currently available on DVD. Stay with us.
Sugar Man, won't you hurry? 'Cause I'm tired of these scenes. For a blue coin, won't you bring back all those colors to my dreams? Silver magic ships you carry, jumpers, coke, sweet Mary Jane. Sugar Man, false friend on a lonely dusty road, lost my heart when I found it. It had jet black hole. Silver magic ships you carry, jumpers, coke, sweet Mary Jane. Sugar man, you're the answer that makes my questions disappear. Sugar man, 'cause I'm weary of those double games I hear. Sugar man, sugar man, sugar man.
We want to jump in for a quick second here to recognize our sponsors this week, including Audible.com. We promised a recommendation or two if you're looking for a new audiobook. Audible, of course, is the internet's leading provider of spoken audio entertainment, providing digital versions of tens of thousands of audiobooks for download. Josh, you're going to give them a title that you recommend.
I am. Next week, we're going to be talking about Stoker. We hope to, at least. And it was partly influenced by another Evil Uncle movie, Alfred Hitchcock's Shadow of a Doubt. I found something pretty cool on Audible, actually, called Academy Award Theater. It was a radio drama series from the 1940s that featured 30-minute adaptations of Oscar-nominated films. So this one has Shadow of a Doubt. It was up for a Best Writing Award in 1944. And this radio version features none other than the movie's Uncle Charlie himself, Joseph Cotten.
Nicely done. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/film. That's audiblepodcast.com/film. We're also brought to you by Squarespace. This is a very popular platform a lot of our listeners use to power their websites or blogs. They are an all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create a professional website or portfolio, whatever you need. And now they do have, Josh, an online store, which I have to say I'm very curious to check out, as we may just need to start selling a few more t-shirts. We've gone through all
that,
of them.
Yep.
So maybe the Squarespace store is the way to go. Their new commerce solution allows you to instantly create a store and start selling products. They always have great customer service and design options, but really the store is what we want to focus on this time. It's a powerful and flexible e-commerce solution that's integrated to work with every Squarespace template. They allow you to sell both physical and digital goods. So if you want to sell music CDs or MP3s or books or ebooks, whatever it is, Squarespace can help you out. They also have a single interface for order management, so you can track orders, provide customers with email updates, print shipping labels, and even add coupons. Squarespace Commerce is included with a business plan subscription, which starts at $24 per month when you sign up for a year, or $30 for a monthly plan.
For a free trial, go to squarespace.com/film. You can sign up for a free account there. You don't even need a credit card. Just try it out and start building your website. If you do decide to purchase it, be sure to use offer code FILM3, and you'll get 10% off your first purchase on new accounts. That includes monthly and annual plans. And don't forget about free domain registrations for annual plan customer subscriptions. That's squarespace.com/film, and use offer code FILM3. Everything you need to create an exceptional website.
Good God, Willoughby. Will you not shake hands with me?
How do you do, Miss Marianne?
Willoughby, what is the matter? Why have you not come to see me? Were you not in London? Have you not received my letters?
Yes, I had the pleasure of receiving the information you were so good as to send me.
For heaven's sake, Willoughby. Tell me what is wrong.
Thank you, I'm most obliged. If you will excuse me, I must rejoin my party.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. That's Kate Winslet and Greg Wise from Sense and Sensibility, directed by Oscar-winning director.
That's right.
Ang Lee won it this year for Life of Pi, also a winner previously for Brokeback Mountain. But we played that clip not really to talk about the Oscars so much as to set up our poll question a bit later in this segment, focusing on non-English filmmakers making their English language debuts. We'll get to that in a moment, but first it's time for everybody's favorite part of the show, Massacre Theater.
We perform a scene and you get a chance at winning a prize. Last week, Michael Phillips helped us massacre this scene.
The morning that I left for college, he walked into my room and he held out his hand and it was filled with money. A big, sweaty wad of money. And he said, "I don't want you to ever come back." And I just grabbed him and I hugged him, and he turned and walked out.
Hey, we all have these terrible stories to get over, and you...
It's not true. Some of us have great stories, pretty stories that take place at lakes with boats and friends and noodle salad. Just no one in this car, but a lot of people, that's their story. Good times, noodle salad. What makes it so hard is not that you had it bad, but that you're that pissed that so many others had it good.
That was Greg Kinnear, Helen Hunt, and Jack Nicholson from 1997's As Good As It Gets, directed by James L. Brooks. Brooks also wrote the screenplay along with Mark Andrus. Max O'Connell from Muncie, Indiana wrote
in. He's a Muncie guy.
He is. He said, "Nice job on The Massacre of James L. Brooks. Overrated As Good As It Gets. A film that takes any of the goodwill I'd give Brooks for terms of endearment and broadcast news and chucks it out the window. Michael and Josh can't quite capture the smugness of Helen Hunt," there's that word again, "and Jack Nicholson's performances, but not many could. The tie-in, of course, is two less-than-deserving Oscar wins for Hunt and Nicholson, some less-than-deserving nominations for picture and screenplay, I'll defend Greg Kinnear, and Hunt's nomination for The Sessions this year."
That is where we were going with the tie-in, thinking about Helen Hunt being nominated for The Sessions this year and her win for As Good As It Gets. It was our Oscar show last week as we made our picks for who will win, not very well, mind you, and who should win. We were a little better there with who should win, I hope. But yes, I am with Max with his disdain for As Good As It Gets.
You almost didn't want to do this scene.
Yeah, I didn't want to do it.
You were so against the movie.
I prefer to pick Massacre Theater scenes that I enjoy talking about, and this is not a film I enjoy talking about.
I believe it was something along the lines of, "I don't even want to give this film any more recognition."
That was it.
Yeah,
that was
harsh.
It. But we also got this great response from Amy Sullivan in Germantown, Maryland. "First, my gratitude to Josh for always taking chances as a performer. As a theater director, my biggest frustration with my actors is the reluctance to take chances. When I listen to Massacre Theater, and Josh, you were doing your Nicholson last week. That was an attempt at a Nicholson.
Yes.
I think noodle salad was the one
I grabbed that one pretty hard.
Line. She says, "When I listen to Massacre Theater, Josh clearly never frustrates me, as most of the time he makes me laugh out loud, causing all sorts of odd looks from my coworkers as I listen to your show. Never change, Josh. I may be your biggest Massacre Theater fan." I think she has some competition with Sam Van Hallgren, our producer. He's an even bigger fan.
Well, they don't have to worry because I wouldn't know what else to do. I don't think I could change. Sorry.
Amy goes on. "Now to the tie-ins. Is it the reluctance to like the smug Helen Hunt?" There it is again. 1997 was a weird year for leading actresses, but honestly, I wanted anyone but Hunt to win that year. I feel the same way this year. Or is it that Nicholson's inexcusably over-the-top performance beat out Duvall's much better, nuanced performance for The Apostle, the way I feared early on Jackman's over-the-top Jean Valjean was going to beat out Day-Lewis's grounded and honest Lincoln? For me, Greg Kinnear was the best thing about As Good As It Gets. While Nicholson and Hunt were begging for nominations, Kinnear gave the most nuanced, honest, and moving performances of his career. But he was overshadowed by the scene-chewing of his co-stars, much as Adam is overshadowed each week by Josh."
I have to admit, I felt
that is my struggle.
Bad. Listening to it, because I think that was your best. And by best, I
went
mean
for it.
Good.
Yeah.
You really
I went for it.
That.
I tried to really feel that pain. I internalized
there were layers,
that.
There were notes, and I just stomped all over it.
I hope that Amy means overshadowed every week during Massacre Theater only and not the review section as well.
I'm pretty sure that's what she's referring to.
I'm not sure. Thank you, Amy and Max, for those great comments. If you do want to hear that rendition, want to hear Josh's Nicholson in case you missed it, and I guess go back and hear how badly we picked the Oscars. You can do that and hear the review of our final Marx Brothers marathon movie, A Night at the Opera. That show is available via filmspotting.net and iTunes. Josh, we did get a lot of entries this week. Many fans out there, few people that don't like it,
despite
like
all
Max,
your
but
efforts to try to keep people from seeing As Good As It Gets.
Or at least they did catch on to your Nicholson and that noodle salad line. So a lot of entries, reach into the brimming film spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
The winner is Joe Puskas from Austin, Texas.
Congratulations, Joe. Email feedback at filmspotting.net and we'll set you up with your free 6-month subscription to Fandor.com.
Because after Salome, we'll make another picture and another picture. You see, this is my life. It always will be.
We move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, presented by Fandor.com, a site to discover, explore, and share independent foreign and classic cinema. More information at Fandor.com/filmspotting.
Help support the show by signing up now. Film Spotting listeners get the first 30 days free.
Well, I don't know what to say about this scene. I guess I'll give a little hint and say we go from Nicholson to another acting heavyweight, maybe two acting heavyweights scene.
But there's a comparable to Nicholson, that's for sure.
I think there definitely is. And we did change one or two words maybe to make it a little more radio friendly, but nothing that significantly alters the script. There are tie-ins. We will let you come up with those tie-ins to this week's show. You're going to start it off, Josh. Are you ready?
Yep.
And action.
Why do you want me to go back to my parents? I mean, they hate me. Why do you think I split in the first place? There ain't nothing there.
Yeah, but you can't live like this. It's a hell. A girl should live at home.
Didn't you ever hear of women's lib?
What do you mean, women's lib? You're younger. You should be at home now. You should be dressed up. You should be going out with boys. You should be going to school. You know, that kind of stuff.
God, you are square.
Hey, I'm not square. You're the one that's square. You're full of crap, man. What are you talking about? You walk out with those creeps and lowlifes and degenerates out on the street.
And scene. That was a good place to end it because it got a little filthy after that.
Yeah, it did. If you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Tuesday, March 5th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
You're going to do very well for yourself. Unless you blow it.
And how am I going to blow it?
By making a pass at me.
What makes you think that's going to happen?
Men always seem to wonder. They think I'd be something very special.
And are you?
Well, no one's ever asked for their money back.
Jonathan Rhys-Meyers and Scarlett Johansson there from Woody Allen's Match Point, his first film outside of his native New York. Of course, he's been on a run of making films in other countries ever since Match Point. And last week on the show, our poll question had to do with filmmakers like Woody who are directly associated with one place and then finally venture outside those confines to some success. We picked five or six filmmakers here that have had a little bit of success outside of their home cities or their chosen city. So we asked you which director long associated with a specific location has done the best work away from home. Your choices were Woody Allen, Clint Eastwood, Abbas Kiarostami, Richard Linklater, David Lynch, and Alexander Payne. Josh, how did it come out?
We had a tie for last place, actually, between Eastwood and Payne. They both received 10%. Receiving only 11% was Kiarostami. David Lynch got 12% of the vote, and then further up top in second place was Richard Linklater with 17%, but a clear winner, Woody Allen, 42%.
Yeah, probably on the strength of the movies we talked about, Match Point, as well as Vicky Cristina Barcelona.
It was a good run
and
there.
More recently, Midnight in Paris. He's had some duds, too.
Yep.
There was a scoop in there. There's recently a To Rome with Love, a Cassandra's Dream.
Yeah.
But he has made a few very good films as well. I think now we can safely say, after seeing like Someone in Love, after seeing Certified Copy, it's really tempting to go back and vote
for
Kiarostami in this poll question. Of course, there were some listeners who took issue with some of our choices. If you look back at it, Alexander Payne, Omaha, very clearly. Kiarostami, not a city necessarily, but definitely Iran. Richard Linklater in Austin, Woody in New York, as we said. Eastwood, we made the California connection, the Old West. But David Lynch did stand out a little bit, or at least he stood out now that we've read this comment from longtime listener Serena.
I'm a bit confused by the David Lynch option. I think he's worked so often in non-LA locales that it's strange to tie him down to one place. Eraserhead took place in a post-apocalyptic world, Elephant Man in London, Twin Peaks in a Washington border town, and I don't know where the hell Dune took place, but it certainly wasn't LA as we know it. I'd argue David Lynch makes movies about the mysterious inhabitants of small towns who has had success moving his stories to LA. I'm ultimately voting for the Texan who can make great movies anywhere, Richard Linklater. In addition to the Before trilogy, he made the underrated New York set Valentine to Theater, Me, and Orson Welles.
He did indeed. A good choice there for Serena. And she's right. Upon further reflection, it's hard to say that David Lynch fit into that poll question. So
and that's clearly your fault because you're the bigger Lynch fan.
Yeah, I think I can maybe blame it on Sam, but maybe I did really want Lynch in there looking back at it. So thank you, Serena, for calling us out on that one. Hopefully we won't get into as much trouble with this week's poll question, though we're in similar territory as we're looking ahead to our planned review next week of the new film from Korean filmmaker Park Chan-wook. It's Stoker. It stars Nicole Kidman and Mia Wasikowska. It's his English language debut. If you don't recognize the name, you may recognize his films. He made the Vengeance trilogy, including probably most famously Old Boy, which is being remade this year by Spike Lee. So our question to you is simply, which of these directors made the best English language debut? And we did leave out of that some of the heavyweight filmmakers. You can think about guys like Roman Polanski and their debuts. We just wanted to focus on more recent filmmakers in the same vein as Park Chan-wook, really over the past 20 years or so.
And the vote here is going to be for the film, not necessarily the filmmaker.
Sure.
Sound right?
Let's go that way.
Well, we have Tomas Alfredson, who made Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, Alejandro Gonzalez in Iñárritu for 21 Grams, Michael Haneke for Funny Games, Ang Lee for Sense and Sensibility, which we heard earlier, Fernando Morales for The Constant Gardener, and lastly, Nicholas Winding Refn for Bronson.
Some good options there, Josh.
Very
where
good
are you
options.
Going?
I'm just going to have to say Bronson.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do like that film quite a bit, so I'm tempted to go there, but I think just to spite you, and in honor of his best foreign language film win, I'm going to go with Funny Games U.S.
Oh, come on.
I'm going Michael Haneke. I don't care if he was remaking, essentially, shot for shot, a previous film he made in
another
language.
Do you care that they're both bad?
I like Funny Games, Josh, and that's why I picked it, just to get a little bit of a rise out of you. We do want to give some credit to the Film Spotting Forum over at filmspotting.net. They inadvertently helped out with this poll. As Sam was coming up with some of the options, he did a Google search for top five English language debuts, and sure enough, came across a thread in the Film Spotting Forum on this topic. So well-covered ground by our Film Spotting listeners already. We look forward to seeing your responses. You can vote now at filmspotting.net.
That's it. You can finish that page.
What did Gerd say about this? You just told him how many people you needed and you're not buying them. You're paying for each of these names.
If you were still working for me, I'd expect you to talk me out of it. It's costing me a fortune.
Well, if you're going to debut a new segment, Josh, you might as well have Liam Neeson get you started there as Oscar Schindler in Steven Spielberg's Schindler's List. And as we were thinking about the Oscars, and we're not going to spend a lot of time on the Oscars really much at all, because I didn't watch any of the ceremony.
It's kind of complicates things if you didn't watch them.
I literally saw 5 minutes of it, and I have to admit, I'm totally fine with that. I've watched less and less of that ceremony over the years. Of course, I've now seen who won, but it's just not something I follow. And I have to say as well, Josh, though I don't know why I'm going to say it because it's just going to make me sound like a grumpy old man, but even following along a little bit later in the night on Twitter and seeing all the obvious snarky comments about Seth MacFarlane, all the obvious snarky comments about Argo, it made me just want to turn Twitter off as well. I think next year I'm not only not going to watch the Oscars, I'm going to shut my phone off.
Yeah, I didn't have Twitter on. You can turn it on or off. Is that how it works?
I believe
you
can.
I turned my Twitter off, and it was a relief. I just watched the show. I actually probably watched it more closely than I have in years, just worked out that way. It was pretty dreadful. It was a long haul and poorly produced. Odd segments. I may have been influenced by the fact that I was watching with my brother-in-law, who had never sat through a ceremony before. Mm-hmm. He was just completely confused about why they were doing things. And
sounds
he
about
made
right.
a lot of sense, actually.
Yeah.
So you didn't miss much.
Well, as we said, we're debuting a new segment. This is something we've kicked around for quite a while. And it's something we've done for quite a while, frankly, in listener feedback and bonus content. Sometimes we'll get these great provocative questions. And we do spend time talking about them on air and throwing it out to our listeners. But it seemed especially appropriate, as we are coming off the Oscars this past weekend, to read this email and throw out this challenge from longtime Film Spotting listener John in Brisbane, Australia.
In a post-Academy Awards haze, I know what you're feeling, John, I'm there too, one often contemplates what might have been, who missed out and who won a statue. Two grudges I have never let go are from awards past. In 1994, when the Best Actor was awarded to Tom Hanks for his role in Philadelphia, I felt it was a travesty. Liam Neeson was clearly the better actor in the Best Picture of that year, Schindler's List. Schindler's List was such a powerful cinema experience that it is still with me today.
John continues, 4 years later in 1998, Cate Blanchett as Elizabeth I was trampled by the marketing power of Miramax when Gwyneth Paltrow won Best Actress for Shakespeare in Love. I would like to say my heart was trampled as well by Viola, but it bounced back. As an Australian, we have a natural resilience. I won't admit it in public, but I did find Shakespeare in Love quite charming. Damn, its whimsical story and amazing cast, Jeffrey Rush and Judi Dench are standouts, plus its wonderful score. What about you guys? You must have some old wounds that have not healed from past Academy Awards. I love this question for a lot of reasons, mainly because I wonder if your wounds haven't healed from this past Academy Awards, Josh, as we get to the Best Picture winner. I'm sure that may come up here in the segment, actually. But I'm going to get into trouble with John before we give our answers to this question, because I'm reading his email. Love it. Know we're going to get to it on the show. But even though I don't have strong feelings one way or another for Tom Hanks in Philadelphia or Liam Neeson and Schindler's List, they're both great actors and they're great in those roles. I didn't really have a horse in that race. I'm perfectly fine with Tom Hanks beating out Liam Neeson there for Philadelphia. I'm really cool with that.
That's one of those where it does feel close. It's not what you'd call a snub, where one is so much lower than the other performance that you're just shocked that it happened. I agree.
Similarly, I will totally admit, as I've done on this show, much to the chagrin of some listeners, and they can deal with it, I like Shakespeare in Love. I think it's a good movie. I actually think it deserved to win the Oscar that year. Yes, ahead of Saving Private Ryan. And I thought Gwyneth Paltrow was fantastic in that role. So even though I love Kate Blanchett and ultimately do value her more as an actress, I was completely fine that year with Gwyneth Paltrow winning.
See, I can't go that far. I think what happens with Shakespeare in Love is that it gets this reputation as a bad film because, rightly so, it's a far lesser film than Saving Private Ryan. It really is. And so for it to beat out Saving Private Ryan, suddenly the backlash becomes huge where, well, it's a terrible movie.
Saving Private Ryan feels that way because it's more grandiose. That doesn't mean it's a better achievement.
It's a far better achievement. Shakespeare in Love is a perfectly fine, enjoyable film, but it's not at the same level. And so that's what I mean about how the Oscars inflate everything. Just because you feel that it's not as good as Saving Private Ryan doesn't mean it's bad, but now it has that reputation
with people. Yeah.
Unfairly, I'd say.
Well, I would say that as well, but obviously I like the film more than you. I would just say about Saving Private Ryan, it's a film that has higher highs than Shakespeare in Love does, but also has much lower lows. Some of those Spielbergian touches unfortunately come through in that film that really do hurt that experience. I still like the film. I am a fan of it, but I was fine with Shakespeare in Love winning, and if that takes away from my already reduced credibility, I'm fine with that. But let's get to those old wounds. Are there any grudges you still hold about past wins or losses?
I don't really have grudges because I don't place that much value on them. Yes, I wish Argo had not won, and there were plenty of people who jumped on Twitter to let me know about it the next day that, oh, see, now you didn't like Argo, but it won Best Picture. That doesn't sway me at all, the fact that it won Best Picture. I just don't think there's any artistic validation in the Oscar process. It's, you know, so clearly political, and there's so many, we talked about them on our Oscar show, so many reasons other than the art itself that go into whether or not a movie wins. So I'm going to go in a little different direction in considering this question. Actually, it's more to me the fact that they do matter in that they give power and influence to the winner. That's where it matters to me, because it will affect the winner's career going forward, gives them the opportunity to do other projects that they might not otherwise have been able to do. So I look back and think about filmmakers, directors mostly, who were nominated, didn't win, and how might their careers have gone differently if they did win? Now, I'm not thinking about some of the obvious historical examples of great directors who are overlooked, like Hitchcock or Howard Hawks or Orson Welles. I mean, they had great careers anyway, even though they were nominated and never won or never nominated. I guess you could say maybe Welles' case, he might have had a different career if he had gotten an Oscar. But the people I'm really thinking of are someone like Jane Campion, maybe, who was nominated for The Piano but didn't win. John Cassavetes is another name that comes to mind, who was nominated but didn't win for A Woman Under the Influence. Or Adam, your beloved David Lynch. He was nominated 3 times as a director. Now, you could say he still made films, the pictures that he wanted to make, but would a win have given him some other resources or power or influence? The pushback to this, I guess, is that it might have ruined these folks too, right? That puts them on the fast track for Hollywood prestige projects then. They're part of the system once they get a Best Director win, and it would dampen whatever made them unique. But I just have to wonder what they might have been able to do if they had that statue and they became Hollywood players in a sense.
Yeah, no, that's a great way to approach this question. And this ground has been well covered even on this show. You can go back and look at a ton of mistakes that were made, or what you perceive as mistakes, including, I love Pulp Fiction. I think it's a better film than Forrest Gump. I wish it had won in 1994. It did not. I don't hold a grudge about that. It doesn't keep me up at night that Pulp Fiction didn't win Best Picture. I'd even say a movie like The King's Speech in 2010, I liked The King's Speech. I was a proponent of that film, but of those 9 or 10 candidates that year, I think there were 4 or 5 better films. So certainly that was a little bit of a disappointment. And you can go back to movies like Do the Right Thing, not getting nominated at all. And you can't even say that it really lost Driving Miss Daisy, because it wasn't even in the race against Driving Miss Daisy. So there are those mistakes. I'm over those. But if I was going to think about 3 that stand out, that are my go-to sort of what were they thinking moments, a lot of people do this, and I know we disagree about this film, but I do go back to the 2006 Oscars right away, and I think about Crash winning Best Picture. It's a film I wasn't a fan of then. Subsequently, I've become even a less fan of it as I've re-seen the movie. And everyone thinks about it in terms of, well, it took the Oscar from Brokeback Mountain.
Right.
That's even my first instinct. And yeah, it would have been pretty great if Brokeback Mountain won, because I think it's a much better film than Crash. But then I looked at the nominees again, and Josh, Crash isn't even close to being the best film of those five, much less Brokeback Mountain. You look at the other four nominees, Capote is a much better film, Munich's a much better film, Good Night and Good Luck, in my mind, is a much better film. So that's disappointing when you've got four pretty good candidates there, pretty strong films. They all lost to a movie that I don't consider that good at all. So Crash is one that stands out. I also have to go back, I think, to 1999, the Best Actor race. Even though there wasn't a performance that year by a leading male I was over the moon about, I like Tom Hanks in Saving Private Ryan, Nick Nolte in Affliction, Ian McKellen was very good in Gods and Monsters, and Edward Norton in American History X, probably where I would have gone. But the fact is, Roberto Benigni? Really? You gave the Oscar to Roberto Benigni for Life is Beautiful? That one still hurts a little bit.
Adam, so, none of those other guys would have walked on top of the chairs.
That's true. That's true. We got that wonderful Oscar moment. So I guess to answer John's question about Oscar grudges, those are the only
those
two that really
bit,
stand
huh?
out for me that I still do feel a little bit of anger about. That was Ask Film Spotting. We hope that we'll get your feedback, we'll get your answers to that question, but also maybe more questions that are along those lines. Give us a nice, easy, but provocative question like that that we can dive into on a future show. Or if you have any other feedback for us, you can email us anytime, feedback@filmspotting.net.
All right, I'm going to make a quick call to my buddy Bob Saccomano. Then we'll get to our list of the best unseen movie characters. The Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Stay with us.
And I'll forget about the girl that said no. Then I'll tell who I want where to go. And I'll forget about your lies and deceit. And your attempts to be so discreet. Maybe today. Symbols of success, then I pursue my own happiness, and you can keep your clocks and routines, then I'll go mend all my shattered dreams, maybe today.
We want to take a moment, as we do here every week on Film Spotting, to recognize our very generous donors, our listeners who have taken some of their hard-earned cash and sent it our way in support of the show. We'll get to those names and a few of their comments here in a moment. Two quick plugs, though, we do want to mention. First, we're big fans of MoviePass. This is the new service that allows you to purchase a monthly subscription so that you pay one set fee and get to see unlimited movies in theaters nationwide. If you want to sign up for MoviePass or check it out, just go to moviepass.com/filmspotting. And if you use the offer code filmspotting, you'll get $10 off your first month. We also encourage you, if you're looking for new podcasts to add to your rotation, we, of course, have mentioned this a lot over the years here on Film Spotting. We have a partnership with Jeff Goldsmith and his podcast, The Q&A.
Well, with award season just wrapping up, Jeff has all of the great speeches and tributes from the 2013 WGA Awards. You'll hear Steven Spielberg, Tony Kushner, Tom Stoppard, and more, so you don't want to miss that. And if you dig filmmaker interviews, don't forget about Jeff's backstory. Issue 04 launched recently on the iPad. Each issue has all sorts of interviews, full-length scripts as well, short films, and a whole bunch more. For those fans of Argo, I hear there are fans of Argo, backstory ran the first 20 pages of the screenplay Lord of Light, which was the real-life script the CIA stole, retitled Argo, and then fooled the Iranian government with. So don't miss checking that out. The cover of the issue features all of the characters of the awards season hanging out at a bar. So imagine when Lincoln had a drink with Django. And you get the idea. You can view high-res images of this cover over at backstory.net.
And again, if you want to check out his podcast, just do a search for the Q&A in iTunes, or you'll find a direct link in the notes for this show at filmspotting.net. With that, we get to our donors for the week. We want to start by thanking a new gold-level donor, Jesse. He's right here in Uptown Chicago.
The last time I donated, it was in honor of my lovely boyfriend, Adam, who turned me on to the show. But this time, it's all for me. Thanks so much for what you do. In this irony-ridden world, the genuineness of the show is what truly makes it stand out. Whether it's taking time to read people's names and to offer heartfelt thanks, or the way you incorporate listener feedback into your sponsors' ads. Oh yeah, not to mention the engaging and insightful film discussion. You guys make Film Spotting feel like a community. I'm glad to be a part of it.
Wow. Great comments. Thank you very much, Jesse.
Pretty
we
nice.
Do really appreciate it. Unfortunately, we're not blessed with great senses of irony. We're Midwesterners.
That's right.
We're snark-free, relatively speaking. So I guess that's a good thing, maybe. We also got a gold-level donation from Michael in Decatur, Georgia.
Long-time listener, first-time donor. I'm not sure which episode number I started with, but I'm pretty sure it was the one where Adam and Maddie reviewed Avatar.
I may have been snarky there.
Yeah, probably.
A little bit.
You guys won me over instantly when you called out that expensive, flashy piece of junk for what it was, and I've been listening ever since. I just married the love of my life on February 9th, and feeling a bit flushed with gifts, I felt it was finally time to pay the dealer. Aside from subscribing monthly, I also wanted to make a donation to give you all a big thank you for the countless hours of film banter you've provided me over the last few years. And Adam and Josh, did either of you catch up with Warm Bodies? And if so, thoughts? My new wife, Maggie, who is beautiful and great, liked it a bit more than I did. Since this is a rare time that we haven't seen eye to eye on a film, I'm curious to see where we would land on the Adam Josh scale.
Well, first of all, congrats to Michael and Maggie on their nuptials. Josh, I have not caught up with Warm Bodies.
I have not. It's a zombie rom-com, from what I understand. And the question I have for Michael then is it really a zombie movie? Because I was told after I mentioned 28 Days Later, and I know that's
I told
long
you not to open up that can of worms and you
conversation
did it.
That that's not really a zombie movie. One of the arguments I heard was that zombies have to be these dead-souled creatures. If it's a romantic comedy, I'm assuming the zombies
they've
have
got a heart.
They have a heart. So I don't think this is really a zombie movie. We need to figure this out.
Let's really not go down that path again with the zombie discussion, but thank you for that. Unfortunately, no, we haven't seen it. Maybe we'll catch up with it and at a later point can chime in. New $5 a month subscribers. These are a few more listeners who have decided to finally pay the dealer. Josh Daniel in Washington, D.C., and Jeffrey Cranor in Brooklyn, New York, who says, thanks for the lively Twitter discussion this afternoon. While we didn't come to many or any agreements on gender issues and side effects, I was certainly easily swayed to donate. This does come from a Twitter conversation I had with this listener, Jeffrey,
yes,
where he asked what we thought about this article in The Atlantic, which I didn't see until Jeffrey tweeted about it, that was called Side Effects Rejects the Usual Sexism of Noir, but is Sexist in Its Own Way. And I read it, and we had a nice back and forth. And I'm going to link to this in the show notes, and I do want people to check it out, but only if you've seen Side Effects. If you haven't seen it, don't read it, because it is filled with spoilers. But Josh, I'm going to ask a dumb question because I know there are times where you've sat across from me and thought I was absolutely crazy, where we haven't seen eye to eye. But you know those times where you read a commentator or a critic and it's very well written and it's very smart, and yet the nuts and bolts, the nitty gritty of their response to a film is so completely opposite everything you saw on screen, you can't believe it. It's like you saw two different movies.
Yes, Adam, I know that feeling.
You know that feeling. Read that article. If you've seen Side Effects, and especially if you've heard our review, check out that article in The Atlantic. The misogyny issue in that film and noir tropes, if you want to get into that, that's great. And I didn't think about the film as being misogynistic at all, but I'm open to that conversation. It's not that that I'm rejecting. It's actually every detail about how this critic reads the film. I see it the complete opposite way. So it's fascinating to me on that level.
Yeah, and I did see this going. I think I jumped in early on this on Twitter, and that let you take over because you seem to be doing a fine job of it. The movie never struck me that way either. It seemed like one of those things where it was an idea being placed upon the movie rather than coming out of the film mm-hmm. itself. That's how it struck me. But yeah, I do want to check this article out. Sounds interesting.
We have another new $5 a month subscriber from another listener in Brooklyn. This is Tobin.
I love the articulate passion debates, the dubious massacre theater performances, and particularly the big episode, top 10 films of all time, top films of the year, rap parties, etc. Michael Phillips is a curmudgeonly joy every time he's on, and I often end up agreeing with him. I think, isn't that Michael's Twitter handle, curmudgeonly joy?
It should be. Or,
actually, it's Phillips Tribune. Oh, yeah, he should change it. One plea. As a screenwriter, I am not surprised but slightly bummed that you guys don't address the script category in year-end shows or Oscar predictions. Obviously, you can't cover everything, but this auteurist focus tends to leave out one of the most fundamental aspects of the success or failure of any given film. A selfish argument on my part, I realize. Still, Maybe throw some love to the poor scribes.
A fair point, and I'm not sure this will get us off the hook, but we did cover those categories a little bit in our bonus content,
yes,
which you can hear at filmspotting.net or if you have the app. So we didn't forsake the writers completely. I'm not going to apologize so much for leaving them out of the big show, though. What I will apologize for, however, is what's been a common trend on this show over the years, and we've apologized for it before, maybe not since you joined the show, but certainly on my part, there's a tendency to be a little too auteurist, to give the director credit for everything, and not mention the screenwriters enough. And a key example of that actually goes back to the previous comment and Side Effects. If you go to filmspotting.net and you look at the show notes, after listening to that review, I actually went and posted right away a little comment in the notes where I just said, wow, another case of us talking about Soderbergh to death, giving him all the credit. I thought that's a great script. I really like that film. So I thought it was a fantastic script, and I didn't give Scott Z. Burns any credit in the show at all. So that's just a problem, and I need to continue to work on it.
Right. I think one of the difficulties for me when it comes to this is not always knowing for sure what to credit the screenwriter for. I mean, lines of dialogue can even be improvised. Obviously, there are writers like Mamet where you know exactly where it's coming from. But for me, it's not so much a disrespect for the craft at all as much as it is just not knowing exactly where to place the critique or credit.
That's a good point. And you know how often directors are, especially directors who have been writers or who are writers, how much they're tweaking things on the set. And it's hard to know exactly where to give all the credit. But in a case like Side Effects, especially as those two have worked together before,
sure,
Burns and Soderbergh, you got to feel like they've got a pretty good relationship. And he certainly deserves more credit than I gave him, which was absolutely none during the show. So with that, I do want to take a moment, Josh, to point out we've had two listeners in a row give us donations from Brooklyn. And just this past weekend in Brooklyn, our sister podcast, Matt and Allison from Film Spotting SVU, had their first live show Videology there in Brooklyn.
A sellout, I understand.
A sellout crowd. I'm halfway through the show. So far, it's been a joy to listen to. It sounds like everything went off without a hitch, though I know there were some hitches in terms of Skype and making sure they could get compliance director Craig Zobel on. They also had Pat Healy, one of the stars of that film, on. So they went pretty aggressive. We never tried to work in a filmmaker via Skype for our live show. So I'm really glad to hear that that went off very well. It's been a treat to listen to. And Matt actually sent me a text pretty late in the morning, about 1 a.m. I was still up Saturday night when they taped this. He sends me a text to say, hey, the show went really well. I'm hanging out with some listeners here who were at the show and are fans of Film Spotting Original Recipe, as he calls our show. And he said at one point that they were debating which Film Spotting co-host was their favorite.
Oh, great.
I hope I did well. I hope I did well in that conversation. But it got me thinking, you know, it could be one of those great debates that listeners could have, like Batman. It's almost like Sam.
Which Sam's, Batman?
Sam's Michael Keaton. I'm going to say Maddie's Val Kilmer.
Okay.
And then that makes you Christian Bale.
Where this is going. I'm Bale. Oh, okay. All
right. So, which Batman is your favorite? Maybe it lines up with your favorite Film Spotting co-host. Who knows?
You don't have enough
of a gravelly voice to be Christian Bale, though.
I'd kind of rather be Keaton, to be honest with you.
Well, I think we all would rather be Michael Keaton, but that doesn't work with the analogy, Josh. So, again, congratulations to Matt and Allison on their live show. Let's go ahead and close out with a few more donations here. Other donors we want to thank: Scott in Antioch, California, Matthew in Rochester, Michigan, and Stephen Wright from Parry Sound, Ontario.
You guys have inspired me to start writing my own movie reviews. I've started my own page through Facebook called Steve's Movie Reviews, and we'll put a link up on the site with that.
Yeah, it's facebook.com/Steve's Movie Reviews.
Oh, that's
even easier. Yeah, can't endorse it, but hey, I love the fact that we've joked about how many listeners have decided to pursue a filmmaking path or gotten into film criticism. Yeah, they've been cursed because they've listened to the show over the years. If other people have decided to try their hand at podcasting or blogging, I love hearing from those people as well. Two more donors we want to thank: Marcus in Chertsey, Surrey.
Having listened to your show since 2009 and only having donated once in 2010, I felt it was about time I dug deep in my pocket to contribute to the show that introduced me to the wonders that were Brick, Moon, and Dogtooth. Between your illustrious podcast and Kermode and Mayo's Wittertainment, I have my education in cinema covered. As a burgeoning filmmaker myself, I constantly ask, what would Adam and Josh say about this scene? And that helps me craft my scripts. Stakes, stakes, stakes. So thank you. From April this year, I will sign up to become a buck a show donor to show my appreciation. I have another more self-serving reason for donating today. I would appreciate it immensely if you were to plug my Kickstarter.co.uk project, Welcome to Culliver City. It's for a crime noir graphic novel I've written while on hiatus from filmmaking, with interweaving stories set in a fictional metropolis of Culliver City. The first volume is called Call 1-800-KILL-A-GUY, and the Kickstarter project is to help me launch the novel at the London MCM Expo in May 2013.
Well, we wish you nothing but the best of luck with that, Marcus. Sounds like a really interesting project, and thanks for the kind words about the show. We close with this one from a longtime listener and a strident supporter of the show, Jimmy in Bethpage, New York. He says, "Dear Film Spotting, while I'm a regular monthly donor to the show already, I'm compelled to make an additional donation to mark Josh's one-year anniversary as co-host of Film Spotting. My hope is that we can start a special fund made up of donations by other listeners and get the masthead on the Film Spotting app corrected so that it will read Adam Kempinar and Josh Larson, not Matty Robinson, even though we remember him fondly. I'm hoping my extra donation this month will kickstart this project and help see it through. Josh has settled in quite nicely at Film Spotting, and though over the past year he has confounded me, Cedar Rapids, really, and even angered me, Argo, it is clear that he simply knows as much about film as anyone in the business and always brings a clear-eyed, considered, and enthusiastic opinion to the proceedings. Cheers to you, Josh, from Jimmy." How much did you pay him to send that in?
Yeah, I got to write that check.
Well, you wouldn't have let him say those comments about Cedar Rapids, though.
That's true. That does hurt a little bit. But no, really, something like this, it actually does mean more when it comes from someone who you've angered. You know, it's just a little more genuine.
Yeah. He's still going to give you some kind words. Anyway, you've won him over, Josh, and I think that does have to count for something. And I think we should just briefly acknowledge it's true that if you download the Film Spotting app, it still says Adam and Maddie.
Yes, that's what I've heard.
And the problem is that we don't control our app. We have a developer who controls it. And even if we want to make updates to it, it's not a matter of just simply flipping a switch and updates are made. We have to completely redesign the graphics. And then even once we do that, we have to get it to the developer and hope that they'll update the app in a timely fashion. And yeah, I have to admit, it's not a money issue. It's just really a time issue to get those new graphics created. So I'm sorry, Josh.
Why did you say that? Now all those people who are lining up to donate,
it's all about the money. We just need a little bit more money and we can make that app awesome.
There you go.
'Cause you've been down on me for too long, and for too long I just put you on. Now I'm tired of lying and I'm sick of trying, 'cause I'm losing who I really am, and I'm not choosing to be like them.
Hi, this is Matthew Vaughn. I am the director of Stardust, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
I ain't going out today. I'm going home. I'm going home because nothing's accomplished here. Anybody talks to this guy,
guess what the machine did?
F*** the machine.
Mountain View, 8 units.
Cops got no right to talk to me that way. I did not rob the place.
Did you hear what I said?
Yeah, he closed the deal.
8 units, Mountain View.
You did that?
Yeah.
F*** you.
Guess who?
When?
Just now.
Guess who?
You just this morning?
Harriet and blah blah Nyborg.
You did that?
Yeah, $82,000.
Those deadbeats.
You're listening to Film Spotting, and what better way to get into our top five unseen characters, a list inspired by our discussion earlier in the show of the new Kiarostami film Like Someone in Love, than to hear a clip from a Film Spotting Pantheon movie, Glengarry Glen Ross. You hear Moss, Shelley the Machine Levine, and Ricky Roma talking about Harriet and blah blah Nyborg. And it became clear, Josh, the other night we were on Twitter and I was throwing out to our Twitter followers at Film Spotting this topic, unseen movie characters. Asked them to reply with the hashtag unseen movie characters. And if you're listening to this show now and want to respond to our choices, you can do that with that hashtag. And we got some great responses. And Ted Schaefer, a listener, wrote in and said, "What about Mitch and Murray from Glengarry?" To which I replied, "Well, you can't forget Lemkin." And then that started this back and forth between me, Tad, and our producer, Sam, where we were just dropping all these names from Glengarry Glen Ross, because that is an eminently quotable film for me. And you realize that you have not only the names I've mentioned, but names like Graff, all these characters who you hear about throughout the movie. They come up again and again, but you never actually see them. Link's wife, the guy who buys the property from Roma and then he has to give it back because his wife doesn't want them to buy it. Even she's an unseen character in that film.
So it's a good thing that it's a Pantheon pick, because otherwise it would have been 1 through 5.
It probably would have been for me. Another Pantheon film that was suggested via Twitter, and I like this one, Josh, came from a listener named C.M. Gardner. He says Nixon and all of the Watergate embroiled staff and all the president's men.
I saw that and thought it was great, so I immediately went to the Pantheon. I don't have the Pantheon memorized yet, Adam. Sorry.
Okay, we're going to work on that.
And it was there. So, yeah, that was a great idea.
So why don't you set up your list and also announce that we are calling this not the Glengarry or all the president's men memorial list, but we do have another film in mind that has come up quite a bit over the years on Film Spotting, including recently since you've joined the show.
Yeah, there was a third that could have been perfect for this list, but I've mentioned In the Mood for Love too much lately. The couple at the center of the film are constantly talking about their respective spouses who they suspect of having an affair. And from what you and I can remember, I haven't watched it in a couple of years, you don't even see a glimpse of those spouses, if I'm remembering correctly.
Mm-hmm. Maybe a quick glimpse, and
quick
that's
one.
It.
Okay. Yeah. So could have counted for this list. We're going to make it the In the Mood for Love memorial instead. When putting together my list, I didn't want it to be a figure who was just mentioned. So maybe those Glengarry characters wouldn't have counted for me. Instead, I want it to be someone who actually propelled the narrative, or in a couple of cases, actually haunted the narrative. I found that fit quite a bit. My number five also came up on Twitter, but for a bunch of different movies, same character, bunch of different movies, God. Everyone wanted to say, God is an unseen character in this film and that film. So I picked one, and it's Diary of a Country Priest. Fresh in our minds because it's the 1951 film that was part of our Bresson Marathon. And I do think that God's absence is central to the theme of this story, in which the title priest, played by Claude Ledoux, continually seeks the divine, yet continually falls short. This is the guy, the priest, after all, who can't pray. That's one of his key characteristics. Now, I do know we spent some time talking about that central sequence in which the priest and the countess have a long theological debate. She's nursing this bitter hatred for God ever since the death of her small son. And during the course of their conversation, she seems to achieve this small sense of peace. So you could argue maybe God shows up there, yet it's still a thing of mystery in that scene. We never really understand how God appears, or even if he really does, or if something else is going on. I mean, this is ultimately a movie about a priest who's seeking God, but really only finds elation on the back of a motorcycle, that famous scene near the ending. So I think we can count God as an unseen character in Diary of a Country Priest.
Yeah, that's a good pick, though I think I will challenge it a little bit. And we got someone else on Twitter, at Feckless Driver, who said God in every Bergman film. And
true.
You could go that
true.
Route. The famous line from Manhattan, Diane Keaton says, Bergman, my God, the silence, we get it. God's silent. But that all said, for me, as I made my choices, I didn't consider God because, with all due respect to anyone out there and their beliefs, there was never a point where Claude Ledoux in that film believed he was ever going to actually meet God. There was never a case where he thought that that entity could ever exist.
Oh, I would
in a way that he would
encounter. With that.
I don't think so.
I don't know exactly how it would happen. I don't know that it would be a floating figure from the sky, but he was seeking the presence.
The presence, sure.
Okay.
But there was never a thought in the audience's mind that we're going to see God at some point in this film.
We'll call God an unseen presence in Diary of a Country Priest.
Well, a couple of the names I'll throw out just to get into the list a little bit. Not quite eligible, someone like Boo Radley in To Kill a Mockingbird is a spectral presence throughout that entire film. But we do get quite a bit of Boo as played by Robert Duvall.
Yeah, he's horribly awkwardly revealed
at the end of the
movie.
Film. And it is a terribly awkward reveal. You're right. Another one that I did consider, and fortunately I didn't have to consider it too hard because it's in the penalty box, but The Shining. Tony, the character that
I
he talks
that
to. That's another
too.
One, though, like God, where I'd say there was never a thought that we'd meet Tony at some point.
No,
that's
but
that's
I really
inside
like
his
it.
Head. I do like that one as well. Like you, I did think about forming my list and have a little bit of criteria, and it was crucial to me that they really did push the story forward, just as you said. And so along those lines, a character that I have a feeling a lot of listeners think of, because many people love this film and I do as well, but LA Confidential and Rollo Tomasi, a character that comes up a couple times and does end up playing a pretty pivotal role, but throughout the film is not a presence mm-hmm. in that movie. So that just didn't quite count for me. The other thing I did consider is how badly I, as a viewer, wanted to meet that character.
Okay.
How badly I wanted to lay my eyes on that character. And so that helped me anyway as I formed my list, because then it started to become less about how good the film is overall and about that character.
Right.
So that's what I tried to focus on here with this list. And my number five is a film noir that I don't think anybody, including myself, would put up there as one of the all-time great film noirs. It's not. It's Lady in the Lake from 1947. It's a film that stars Robert Montgomery, directed by Robert Montgomery, and he's playing Philip Marlowe, one of the all-time iconic hard-boiled detective film noir characters. But there is a gimmick to this film. And the gimmick is that those stories were famously written, like most hard-boiled detective novels, written in that first-person perspective where you are inside Philip Marlowe's head all the time. So what Montgomery and the studio tried to do, their gimmick with Lady in the Lake, and the way they really did market this film and try to push it onto audiences was, we're going to give you the first cinematic realization of that. We're going to give you that first-person detective perspective by making the camera stand in for Philip Marlowe. And so we never, except we do in a few glimpses, we don't see Robert Montgomery as Philip Marlowe. The camera is always his perspective. So if he's having a conversation with someone, that character is looking back right into the camera.
There'll be an item on your bill for bribes I spent finding out Muriel Chess had another name.
What?
Yeah, Mildred Haviland. Did you ever hear of her? Muriel Chess married your boss's caretaker after meeting him in a bar in San Bernardino. But her real name was Mildred Haviland. And she married Chess because she wanted a place to hide. It seems that a tough cop was after her.
What's this got to do with Crystal Kingsbury?
I'm coming to that. She and Muriel, or shall I call her Mildred, had a fight over a man.
What man?
The guy I was slipping the $20 bills to kept claiming he didn't know his name.
But I suppose you do.
Yeah. I stopped beating his brains out with money and started snooping for myself, and look what I found.
Now, there's kind of a famous sequence where he's talking to somebody about this case he's working on, and he gets close to a mirror, and we do get to see him reflected in the mirror. So even though we do get a glimpse of him, I still think it works as an unseen character, because that's the whole conceit of the film is, who is this guy? What does he look like? But more importantly, what's his perspective? And trying to then put that perspective onto the audience. It's mostly fun to go back and watch now as a curio, I think. The gimmick actually does detract from the film overall. We didn't need that kind of blatant realization of it. It works just fine in other movies where we follow that character. But I still think for this list, it was one that seemed appropriate to me. And I wanted to see this version of Marlowe that they were holding back from us.
I'm not so sure about that one, but I'm going to allow it only because it reminds me of that opening scene of Kiarostami's Like Someone in Love, in which the speaker we don't see is in some ways looking through the camera in that opening scene. And I didn't think of her as an unseen character. I was thinking of the grandmother. So I like the tie in there. So
I mean, it qualifies. You see a glimpse. That's it, Josh. Come on.
Yeah, but if he's talking the whole time, I mean, unseen, that's an awfully literal.
What's wrong with literal? What's wrong with being literal about this?
I don't know. It's all right. It's all right. I'm going to stick with film noir for my number four, and that's Floyd Thursby in The Maltese Falcon. In this famously naughty plot, which was adapted by John Huston from the Dashiell Hammett novel, Thursby is both the first domino and the second MacGuffin. You kind of need those sorts of elements in film noirs. Now, Mary Astor's femme fatale starts things off by coming to the office of Humphrey Bogart. He's a private eye, and she claims she's looking for her sister, who has moved in with a man named Floyd Thursby.
Mr. Spade, I have a terrible, terrible confession to make. That story I told you yesterday was just a story.
Oh, that. Well, we didn't exactly believe your story, Miss. What is your name, Wonderly or LeBlanc?
It's really O'Shaughnessy, Bridget O'Shaughnessy.
We didn't exactly believe your story, Miss O'Shaughnessy. We believed you $200.
You mean that?
I mean you paid us more than if you'd been telling us the truth, and enough more to make it all right.
Tell me, Mr. Spade, am I to blame for last night?
Well, you warned us that Thursby was dangerous. Of course, you lied to us about your sister and all that, but that didn't count. We didn't believe you. No, I wouldn't say that you were at fault.
Thank you. Mr. Archer was so alive yesterday, so solid and hearty.
Stop it. You know what he was doing. Those are the chances we take.
Now, Thursby may have been dangerous, but he does wind up dead well before we ever get a chance to see him. So like the Falcon itself, he's enough of a MacGuffin to keep this plot spinning. That's all he's really there for.
Yeah.
He's the first one to kick it off. And that's fine, because that just allows us to sit back and watch this absolutely great cast just immerse themselves in great dialogue, timeless style. Love that picture.
It's a great film and a great pick, an honorable mention for me. I did consider Floyd Thursby, and as I was considering it, I did a little bit of research on The Maltese Falcon to try to remind myself just how much he factors into the film. And it's in a major way. His name comes up, it seems like, every 15 minutes, if not more, in that film. And yet you don't ever see him. So you really do just have to buy into the fact that there's this presence that's filling a major role in the plot. But he is a complete ghost in that film. My number four is so unseen that he doesn't even actually have a name. He's the tanker truck driver from the Steven Spielberg film Duel. Comes from 1971. It was a TV movie. Early Spielberg here, obviously. It's not one of his best films, but you can go back and see some of the action elements in this movie and see some of the early Spielberg tricks that are really effective at work in Duel. It's a very simple story, very bare bones, about a salesman played by Dennis Weaver who is on a business trip that takes him out on the open road a little bit, and he gets into a little bit of an aggressive back and forth with this tanker truck driver. He passes him, he gets frustrated with him, and rather than just falling in behind him and disappearing, this truck driver decides that he's going to take it out on Dennis Weaver, that he's not going to let Dennis Weaver try to push him around or get the better of him. And it becomes this duel. It becomes this cat and mouse chase where the truck driver is really the key aggressor here. And as I mentioned, I wanted to go with characters I really wanted to see. I wanted to see who this truck driver was so bad when I watched Duel, because you only get glimpses of him through the windshield. You can never really make out his face. And maybe the best sequence in the film actually is one that doesn't take place on the road at all. It's when the truck stops at a restaurant or some kind of diner, and Dennis Weaver sees that, and he stops as well, and he decides he's going to try and confront him.
Why didn't I leave right away when I saw his truck outside? Then I'd know what he intends to do. What if he followed me out, though? Started after me again? I'd be right back where I started. Even if I got a lead, he'd overtake me soon enough. He's got some souped-up diesel. My car's just not that powerful. I just can't drive 80 and 90 miles an hour. As soon as I stop concentrating, I'd go back to 60 or 70 like I always do. It's a habit. I can't help it. He's just like... Take it easy. Just take it easy.
I love that sequence because this movie really is all about masculinity.
Oh,
and you've
sure.
got this
yes.
character in Dennis Weaver who is going through this crisis where we see other elements in the film that are playing into this. His wife is disappointed that he didn't stand up for her and defend her against a fellow coworker, I think, who was coming on to her. And he's being pushed around by his bosses and doing things he doesn't really want to do. And so then this manifests itself. It comes out on the open road where is he going to get pushed around by this truck driver, as he is for most of it, or is he going to stand up to him? That dynamic really plays out. And in that diner sequence, we get that inner monologue that he's having where he's trying to decide basically if he's going to have the fortitude to confront this truck driver. And you hear all those things going through his head. As I said on our live show, our 400th show, Josh, for all the people out there who are Jimmy Stewarts like me, who want to be John Waynes, that's us in that sequence. We're the guys who are sitting there at the diner worrying and so anxious. And we don't know what we would say to the guy if we ever got up in his face, but we don't feel like we could completely defend ourselves if it ever got really physical and got really aggressive. So I really do appreciate that movie on a couple of different levels, and I so badly wanted to see that truck driver and try to understand why he was pushing poor Dennis Weaver around, so he had to make this list.
You're so right about Duel. It's such an action movie in a lot of ways and a thriller, yet the best scenes are off the road. That phone call you mentioned, it's such an emasculating conversation he has with his wife. I really like that movie a lot too. My number three, you mentioned earlier in the show, because it is in a lot of ways the definitive movie for this list, and it is Hitchcock's Rebecca. This is his 1940 Best Picture winner, and Rebecca is the recently deceased wife of Laurence Olivier's obscenely wealthy English aristocrat. Joan Fontaine plays the young woman who becomes his second wife, and she's haunted by Rebecca when they move into this sprawling English estate where they live. It's just an amazing grounds and mansion, just goes on and on and on. The servants are always mentioning Rebecca, especially the insidious Mrs. Danvers, played by Judith Anderson.
Mrs. De Winter? Oh, I'm afraid you've made a mistake. Mrs. De Winter's been dead for over a year.
That was the house telephone, madam. Probably the head gardener wishing instructions.
Did you want to see me, Mrs. Danvers?
Mr. De Winter informed me that his sister, Mrs. Lacey, and Major Lacey are expected for luncheon. I'd like to know if you approve of the menu.
Well, I'm sure it's very suitable, very, very nice indeed.
You'll notice, madam, that I've left a blank space for the sauce. Mrs. De Winter was most particular about sauces.
The monogram stationery and linens are everywhere. It's almost cruel the way he hasn't had any of this stuff removed. And then we have the West Wing, where Rebecca spent her time. Now it's closed up and kept by Mrs. Danvers as this really grotesque sort of museum. Rebecca is such a real presence in this film that I bet, and this speaks a little bit to what you're talking about, who you wanted to see the most. I bet everyone who's seen this movie has an idea in their head of what Rebecca looks like. In some way, they can picture her face. And it's probably drawn from another actress. For some reason, early 90s Debbie Mazar from about the time of Goodfellas. That's my Rebecca.
Okay. Well, that's a great challenge for our listeners out there to write in with your image of Rebecca. You can email us feedback at filmspotting.net. You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Josh. We're sharing our top five unseen characters in movies. And we go from one Hitchcock film, Josh, on your list, to my Hitchcock pick. And there are a couple others we could talk about. Certainly one very famous.
Could have been an all-Hitchcock list.
It could have been an all-Hitchcock list. But I had to go with George Kaplan. 1959's North by Northwest. This is, of course, the famous movie where Cary Grant is, I believe, an insurance salesman of some kind, just kind of a mild-mannered guy, and he gets mistaken for this CIA agent or this espionage guy named George Kaplan. And the whole film is just this case of mistaken identity, and we see our hero, Cary Grant, get in more and more deep water, though at later points in the film, he ends up ultimately embracing it. In order to try to get to the end of this and figure out the whole story here and get himself out of it, he has to actually pretend to be George Kaplan. So I like that element to what happens. Now, later in the movie, we do discover that, well, nobody was ever going to meet the real George Kaplan. Spoiler alert, George Kaplan doesn't exist. He was an invention by another character in the story. But the fact is, he so dominates the movie North by Northwest, and as a viewer, feeling sorry for poor Cary Grant, you want so badly for this to get straightened out. We want to see the real George Kaplan. Where could the real George Kaplan be? And we're looking for all those little clues, the hotel he stays in, whatever it is, but he never surfaces. We find out later why, as I touched on, but that for me was one of the definitive picks when I thought about this list, George Kaplan and North by Northwest.
Well, you're right. One reason he has such a presence is because Cary Grant does become him. I mean, yeah, by the end, he is George Kaplan. So that really does resonate. My number two, I'm going with a comedy, Mort Guffman from Waiting for Guffman. The best Christopher Guest mockumentary? I guess it depends whether or not you include This is Spinal Tap in that group.
Yeah, that's
group
true.
Or not.
But I also really like Best in Show.
Do you? Okay. Yeah. Best in Show, yeah, that may have the most laughs, that's for sure. Well, Waiting for Guffman revolves around the community theater production that this delusional director, Corky St. Clair, played by Guest himself, hopes is going to be his launching pad to Broadway. So to that end, he tells the cast and crew that he's invited this Broadway producer, Mort Guffman, to attend.
Mr. Guffman brings with him a reputation, something bigger than anyone in this town has ever known. And if I am to get back to New York City on my terms, I cannot deliver him a stinky product. I really have to be presenting him a package, a beautifully wrapped, glossy, sweet-smelling show.
So even though this is the usual cast of idiots, let's be honest, that Guest usually compiles, your heart still breaks for these people when Guffman doesn't show up and the show must go on. And then it breaks again because some guy who's just coming through town happens to sit in the reserved seat that was set aside for Guffman. They think it's him. The end of the show, it proves to be no one important, and it just hits you again. And I think that's what makes Guffman, maybe for me, one of Guest's more affectionate spoofs, and probably his best in my book.
Yeah, it's definitely up there. I'm a big fan of that movie, and that's another great pick that I considered. Waiting for Guffman is an honorable mention for me on this list. My number two film, I didn't think necessarily had a connection to yours, but it does in the sense that when you think about great filmmakers who use ensembles very well and almost always work in large ensembles, you think about Christopher Guest and you think about the director of my number two film, Robert Altman. The movie is Nashville. The unseen character, Hal Philip Walker. I don't know, maybe you'll disagree with this one, Josh, because we do hear from Hal Philip Walker. We hear famously one of his speeches in Nashville, but he's a character who, in true form with this list, we don't ever see, but who is a huge part of every aspect of this film. There's something like 24 characters in this movie, all these overlapping storylines, they do ultimately all come together at this political rally for Hal Philip Walker. But every character in the movie, whether a musician or some other kind of entertainer, their actions all revolve around this candidate and this candidate's rally that is coming up. And the fact is, Nashville's a film that's come up a few times over the years, but hasn't probably gotten as much love here on the show as it deserves. So when you think about that character who is kind of the glue for 24 different characters, that seemed appropriate for this list.
Yeah, they all do spin around him, so that does make sense. My number one, I'm so glad I didn't waste this pick on survival movies because I had considered it. But it's perfect here. It's my number one. It's The Blair Witch in The Blair Witch Project.
We're doing a documentary
about
the Blair Witch.
Oh.
Oh, have you heard of The Blair Witch?
Oh, yeah. That's an old story. So I remember Mr. Parr was an old hermit.
Right.
And he lived up on a mountain. He had a place up there. Been there for a long, long time.
You've heard of the Blair Witch?
Several times.
Several times. And what was the first incident?
I've heard stories about her from people and neighbors and stuff like that, but also I saw a documentary on the Discovery Channel or somewhere.
Really?
Once about her, about the ghosts and legends of Maryland.
Yeah, it's a story my grandmother used to tell us all. Make us go to bed early.
Really?
Say if you stay up after dark or walk around the house too much, a Blair Witch would come and get you.
Sort of in the winter, I guess, the fall or the winter, 1940, some of the young kids started to disappear, and nobody knew anything about why they were disappearing.
The creepiest story about her that I ever heard was that two men were out hunting, and they were camped near the cabin or something that she's supposed to haunt. And they disappeared off the face of the earth.
No.
Really?
Okay, it's all right, Ingrid. I'm just telling a scary story, but it's not true.
That clip actually captures one of the ingenious moments of the film, just a small one at the start. But when this woman is talking and she's holding a toddler, as she talks about the witch, the toddler starts whimpering and tries to cover her mouth to keep her from talking. I have no idea if that was planned, if someone's poking the kid or what was going on, but it was just chilling when I first saw that. This was my top movie of 1999. Just for the way it really reinvented the horror genre. It certainly paved the way for all the DIY, technologically driven sort of horror that we're getting with movies like the Paranormal Activity series today. You could argue, does the Blair Witch show up in the final scene? That's just one of the great debates that this movie inspired. So love this movie, loved it for this list.
Yeah, I never considered it being a film that really could top a top 10 list at the end of the year. I didn't know anyone loved it that much.
Yeah. Oh,
but
yeah.
But I really liked it as well, and that movie terrified me.
Yes.
So,
did you see
getting
it early
past
on?
All the hype.
Let me ask, did you see it early on? Because I think that was crucial to appreciating it, is to see it before people took it as a challenge, not to be scared.
Yeah, you're right. And a lot of people did that. I think I still saw it when everyone saw it as a challenge, and you kind of knew what you were getting into,
and it worked.
It still really worked for
good.
Me. So I am a fan of that movie as well. There are actually all sorts of nice little connections between our picks this week, Josh. We go from your comments about the Blair Witch and the toddler to a potential toddler, at least a child, in my number one, and it's the boy, we'll call him the son, of George and Martha in Mike Nichols' film Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. Anybody who's seen that film or, of course, read the famous play, you know that this character, their alleged son, who they talk about throughout the film and comes up again and again as they're entertaining, if you want to call it entertaining, this new couple, this new member of the faculty and his wife at the school that George teaches at, they start asking all these questions. Oh, we didn't know you had a son. And he comes up again and again until the end of the film, which at this point, there shouldn't be any worries about spoiler alerts, but I'll simply say one of the characters chooses to do something very definitive in relation to this character, their son. And there are some truths revealed about the nature of this son and whether or not said son actually ever existed or was more something that this couple held on to. It was almost the thing that kept them together in a way, this fairy tale, this game that they had sort of imagined. And the events of the night we see in this film do all culminate with an action by one of the characters that really changes their relationship probably forever. It's the end of the film, so we'll never know, but it's something that you can't really take back, and it does all revolve around their alleged son. So that's Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, my number one.
See, I thought you were going with Rosemary's Baby when you started there, but
Rosemary's Baby and Satan. I'm going to just say Satan is the character that's unseen that I want to see.
Okay.
And Rosemary's Baby, an honorable mention for me.
Let's bookend things with God and Satan. I like it.
Perfect. What about some other honorable mentions, Josh? Any other picks that really troubled you to leave off?
We talked about Richard Nixon and All the President's Men. We also talked about all the Hitchcock titles we could do. Mother from Psycho is the one that I wanted to put on. And the Zodiac Killer in Zodiac.
Ooh.
Perhaps. I don't
perhaps
know.
Perhaps we see him.
A little iffy there. I also meant to catch up with, because we were talking about Kiarostami this week, The Wind Will Carry Us, which I've never seen, but from what I understand, several characters are not seen in that film. I couldn't get a hold of a copy in time. It wasn't widely available.
Okay.
So, no luck.
Well, nice try. Some other honorable mentions for me that haven't come up yet, going from a great play to another great play on film that you hate, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. I wanted to mention Skipper so bad, the character that Paul Newman had that deep, quote-unquote, friendship with.
Uh-huh.
He looms over that entire film. I wanted to include it, Josh, just so I could chide you because you don't like that film and I love it, but also so I could do my Liz Taylor, as she calls him Skipper. Skipper. It's just so fun to say.
You'd have to do a lot of screaming, too, and your voice just recovered, so
that's
I'm
true.
Glad you didn't
that's
go
true.
With it.
I had to leave it off. What about the person who leaves the tape in Michael Haneke's cachet? I want to know who's behind that mystery.
I like that.
Bonnie in Pulp Fiction, not a big enough factor in the film. That's why I'm only mentioning it here. But famously, Quentin Tarantino's character, Jimmy, his wife in that movie. And another one that came in via Twitter, Toss, he is at Stevens Points. He says, best of recent unseen movie characters is Carla from Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy.
Yeah.
Never seen, but still a worthy enemy of Oldman's character in that movie. That one is good as well. I'll have to give a nod to my wife, Sarah, who, as I was telling her about this list tonight, she did say, what about Diane from Twin Peaks? Kyle MacLachlan's always talking into his tape recorder to Diane. Maybe not a big enough part of the movie Fire Walk With Me. That's more TV, but still a character in Agent Cooper and in Diane I love. I adore that series, so wanted to give a little bit of a shout-out. More David Lynch love here coming on the show, Josh. Couldn't help myself. Those are our top five unseen movie characters. Send us your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463. Or find us on Twitter at FilmSpotting and at Facebook.com/FilmSpotting.
Out wide this weekend, Jack the Giant Slayer. Speaking of directors who may need a comeback, Bryan Singer.
That's who's making
of the Usual Suspects and X-Men. I believe it's the same Bryan Singer anyway.
Well, before you write it off, did you notice in the commercials, one of those giants has two heads, Adam? I mean, that might pull you in.
I didn't see that.
It's true.
If only I'd paid more attention. Nicholas Holt in that film, Ewan McGregor, some other great character actors who, hey, if they're just getting a payday, we'll give them a pass. Stanley Tucci, Eddie Marzan, Ian McShane, Bill Nye, all great actors there in Jack the Giant Slayer. Also out, 21 and Over. This is from the writing team behind The Hangover. They are directing 21 Over. And if you've seen the preview for it, it really looks a lot like The Hangover, but with younger people.
So a prequel.
It's a prequel to The Hangover.
Okay.
Well done. And then also out in wide release, you can see The Last Exorcism Part 2. And I'm just going to read this straight from our notes here. Got to give credit to Sam. Did they hesitate for even a second before slapping a 2 on the end of a movie that has last in the title? I mean, really, that is genius.
I think once they saw that they had exorcism in the title, they felt good. And whatever else happened,
the last one, but we're going to do another film. Why not? Out in limited release, opening here in Chicago, A Place at the Table. This is a documentary about hunger in America. The dude, Jeff Bridges, narrates. And Stoker, a psychological thriller from Park Chan-wook that stars Nicole Kidman and Mia Wasikowska. That is the film that right now we're planning on reviewing next week on the show, along with sharing our top five mother-daughter movies. Or is it movie mother-daughters? Are we focusing on the films or the pairings, Josh?
Or is it mother-daughter relationships?
Well,
because earlier we did mother-son relationships.
We have done mother-son relationships. So we have a lot to iron out here.
We do.
As we get ready for next week's show.
Many, many emails.
I sense a lot of emails.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to Tori Malatia and Shauna Coyne at WBEZ. Our featured music this week was by Rodriguez from the Searching for Sugar Man soundtrack. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.